everyone. Here we are, third week of September. It's the 20th, the day I'm recording. Hopefully I'll get this posted today, if not tomorrow. And I hope you're having a beautiful season. Beautiful autumnal season, officially this week, if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. And for our friends who tune in from far away, if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, how does it feel to be leaning into spring right now? I'm sure it feels really wonderful. So the harvest moon has dazzled us with its fullness, and we are now in the waning phase of that cycle. So I'd like to begin by offering my poetry for the full and waning harvest moon. Late harvest peach, fuzzy rub against my top lip, ticklish. I linger. Closing my eyes, I see the past rays of summer. I hear bits of laughter. My tongue touching the dry soft, which is instantly the wet skin. Then explosion of sweet, gentle tear. Nick the pit. Pull away. I open my eyes. I swallow the moon. I just saw fresh peaches yesterday at the store when I was out and about, and living this close to Georgia now, we get lovely peaches in this area and beautiful apples this time of year. The little road stop produce stands are so charming, and I just love all of the harvest-centered visual feasts of this time of year, the scents, the sounds, the cooler air as I walk at night. A couple times I've just needed a light sweater, and I love that feeling of just needing a little light sweater, not anything too harsh. And I got a seasonal cold. If I'm sounding a little sultry today, that's the end of my cold. So there's that, which tends to happen when everybody goes back to school or work environments. Here's what I wrote about the waning moon. Ever present in the fullness, ever present in the satiety, ever present in the round is the black, the emptiness, the hunger, the sliver. And today, I trust this. As we welcome the autumnal equinox, you know, obviously the days are getting shorter, markedly so. And we're moving into the dark time of the year. And although I love every season, there's something incredibly soulful to me about Persephone's return to the underworld. And indeed, we'll touch a little bit on her today. And I'm right now planning for the second podcast of September to be about her. Because, of course, as she bursts forth in the springtime, that is a time to celebrate. But her reign in the underworld is so important psychologically to understand. And I would offer that, again, although all of us have the masculine and the feminine, if you would rather say the yin and the yang, the active and the receptive aspects of duality within each of us, I do really love the Persephone figure for lending nuance and power to the feminine experience of individuation, coming home to the divine self, however you want to say that. There are some wonderful examples in the culture and in mythology and in psychology of the masculine journey. But there's less said about the feminine journey. And again, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter because it's the human journey back to the divine self. So it's above and beyond gender. Having said that, there are some important aspects of the feminine that I'm studying right now, just in my own walk, and I'm looking and doing some research regarding that. So we'll just put a pin in that for right now, that we're going to return to our conversation about Persephone, which I tend to do every so often in this course of this podcast, because she's so powerful. She's such an amazing figure, and I want to talk more about her. I want to experience more of her in my life, and I want to talk about her next time. So that's sort of the plan for right now. But what we're going to do today is talk about another archetype that has certainly been alive in our culture the last couple weeks, and that is due to the passing of Queen Elizabeth. And, you know, of course, we're all aware of both, you know, admirable things about her reign. We all probably have very particular views and beliefs about the monarchy, whether we're American or British or other nationalities, whether there should be a monarchy, whether this idea of hierarchical class system is relevant, you know, on and on and on. Colonialism, there's all kinds of really important, difficult, layered, nuanced conversations to be had around that. That's not what I'm going to be touching on today. I'm talking about the archetypal core of the term sovereign. That's what I want to talk about today, because that belongs to every single human being. Sovereignty. Sovereignty. So just to situate that a little bit, you know, let's look at these three terms of celebrity, royalty, and sovereignty, because they sort of seem related on one level, but they're really different. And I just want to dive in a bit to this idea of sovereignty. And I'm going to be using the help of other texts and other authors today to sort of just explore. And I don't really have an agenda about what I want us to arrive at, because A, I don't do that with you. And I'm still sort of figuring out myself, but it feels akin to all that we've been exploring in the podcast. And so perhaps it's just another way of coming at this beautiful idea we've been nurturing along, which is we are our most authentic, vibrant selves when we are in that filterless state. Okay, that filterless state. And what do I mean by that? If you've been following along with me, what I mean is in that state where we're not looking at life through the lens of our story, of our gender, of our position in society, of our bank account, of our narrative on any level, of our nationality, of the day we just had, you know, 10 minutes ago. We are approaching the present moment and the wonder of all that is available to us in that instance. And so we have access to that authentic unfolding. Indeed, you could call it, you know, the cosmos generating themselves in any given present moment. If we have these preconceived ideas, these preconceived stories, these emotional or convoluted thought systems getting in the way, then we tend to create other outcomes for ourselves because that's the lens through which we are seeing. So this filterless state, as we have talked about before, is something I would like to embrace in terms of this archetype of sovereignty. And again, I love that because Elizabeth now King Charles III, we're going to be seeing so many reminders of quote-unquote royalty in the culture right now. And we can enjoy this on the level of the culture or have discussions about it. But I love the idea of perhaps taking those images, because they're going to be so prevalent right now, and just linking that, if it feels appropriate to you, to the idea of sovereignty in yourself and in others, of course. Just anytime you see anything going on about Elizabeth or King Charles or the quote-unquote royals, that we just are reminded about our own sovereign state. And just notice if you happen to be in it right then, or if you're clouded over with thoughts or emotions or narratives. And if you are, that's fine. That's what happens. But maybe just put a little space around that and see if your life opens and expands in response to dropping into that sovereign state. So another way of saying this would be C.G. Jung's concept of the self with a capital S. So not the little self or the egoic self with all the stories, with all the experiences, but the self meaning the divine integration of the psyche, of all of the aspects, of all of the duality. Access to that powerhouse and that space of peace. You know, that is incredibly archetypal and even beyond archetype, I would say. Although, you know, maybe the ultimate archetype, maybe we would say. That's what I like thinking of in terms of sovereignty. But let's situate this term a little bit. Celebrity is something I would argue we know a little bit more about in the American culture. There's a lot of emphasis on celebrity. So just being famous for whatever reason, not even necessarily noble reasons. And of course, now in the age of TikTok and all the social media, I mean, you can become a celebrity for the most bizarre reasons. But there you are with, you know, 5 million followers for, I don't know, the strangest things, you know, like making smoothies or something. Nothing wrong with that, I guess. You know, but it's just kind of a of our times. For me, I don't crave celebrity personally. You know, I have a business and I love connecting with folks, and I want what I'm creating to have a healthy and growing audience. But that's a different thing to me than celebrity. Then there's the idea of royalty, which we really don't have here, other than, you know, I suppose the Kennedys are sometimes considered American royalty, but as, again, noble as many of the things they did or did not do, you know, that could be argued. You know, we see very human, flawed stories in all of those figures as well. So royalty is not something that really fits in my worldview either, but certainly in some countries that is a part of it, and it's a very cherished part of it. You know, I've heard British people speak about what the monarchy means to them, and you know, it's beautiful. It's a cultural phenomenon, and arguably, you know, the Queen has been such a constant in the British society for so long that it feels like you had somebody there going through all the changes, all the celebrations, all the tragedies with you. And so I can see that beautiful constant. And then two, the royals are to be apolitical and not really weigh in on what the government is doing. So there's this idea that they are there for everyone, and they represent an aspect of life that is elevated above those arguments, perhaps we could say. So there is that sensibility, and I can see its value, although I haven't experienced it firsthand, being from the U.S. And then finally, this idea of sovereignty, which I think royalty can point toward, but it depends on the royal, if you will. sovereignty, as we are describing it here in the context of today, meaning that divine, unfiltered, dynamic, integrated psychic self. You know, I know divine is a word that people sometimes don't like, and that's fine, just toss it, you know, but integrated psyche, however you want to say that, whatever terms are comfortable for you, but the you who is not at all in your own way. That being the sovereign self. I think at the end of the day, royalty, if it's pointing to that, could be massively valuable. So having a cultural symbolic system where the idea that we are all sovereign when we are most at home with ourselves and we're not in mental or emotionally destructive patterns or limiting patterns or limiting stories, that is a fabulous use of the term. It's a fabulous image to link royalty and sovereignty as a reminder that no matter what's going on in politics, that we all belong to that when we are our most authentic selves. And again, depending on the actual royal human being, that person could be a wonderful representation of that sovereignty or a less inspired version of that. I think in many ways, Elizabeth is a great example of that. You know, obviously you have your own opinion about that. You know, I don't know everything about her life at all, but I think there's much to honor and be inspired by. And opening up this idea that as often as we're going to hear about royals and the monarchy, just linking that idea to an inner sovereignty with ourselves, I think is a really beautiful thing to take into the fall, because it is a time typically of abundance and harvest. And what beautiful time, what abundance to celebrate this state of being that represents that. And so before I dive into some texts to help us flesh out this idea of sovereignty, I want to add one other thought. And that is, when we look at the quote-unquote royals' lives, you know, it's very easy to say, oh man, you know, everything's paid for. They have all these fancy clothes and food and castles and events and all the rest of it. You know, that life is perfect. And of course, on second thought, we might say, no, that life is like living in a fishbowl, and these are human beings too. But just off the cuff, one could look at royal life and say, oh man, they've got it made in the external sense. And again, we're not talking about this inner psychic state of sovereignty when I say this, but this idea of it's perfect, you know, it's beautiful, it's lavish, it's luxe, all of that together. So riffing off that idea, I want to bring in our dialogue about sovereignty today, another way of getting at that state is to declare all is perfect right now. All is well. Everything is just as it should be right now. If every fiber in your being wants to scream against that, that's perfect. And I get that. And that's why we're going to use this as an exercise to access our sovereignty. So I'll return to that idea at the end, after we've examined the other texts and the other authors' perspectives that I want to share with you today. This is a great exercise into the sovereign state. And if you remember from any of our quantum, quote-unquote, conversations that we've had in the past, the feeling state or the identity state precedes the external state. The internal creates the external state of affairs. And so we're riffing on that idea again and coming into a harmony about all being well, no matter what is going on externally, accessing that place, and then that is having a creative effect on external events, but the inner precedes the outer. You know, the more I travel, I just keep getting this again and again and again, and I keep leaning into this, and I keep working with this principle, and I'm so encouraged because it feels like the only place where we're all equal, where we all have equal access to power and affecting change. And I mean power in the really magnanimous in service to life sense, not a power trip sense. So I think this is incredibly fruitful work, but we'll just put a little pin in that until after we have talked more through the podcast, and we'll return to that idea at the end about all is well now. All is perfect now, opening us up to our own sovereign state. So the first text I want to share with you is an essay. It was actually a talk given by Philip Pullman, the author, the British author, and it's in a compilation of essays and talks called Diamond Voices. Let me read front here on stories and storytelling. And I have read from this in previous podcasts. It's been a while, but I absolutely adore Philip Pullman as a storyteller, as a writer, and as a wise and good person. And so I highly recommend this book of essays. I recommend his fiction. It's so phenomenal and magical and mythological and smart and full of goodness and challenging. And challenging because he is not, you know, a fan of the traditional idea of religion. Is he agnostic? Is he atheist? I don't know how to define him. I'll let him speak for himself. But this essay that I'm going to share with you is actually, I'll just read straight from the book. This talk was given at a study day with the Bishop of Oxford at the Oxford University Department for Continuing Education, Ruley House, Oxford, on 5 October 2002. And the Bishop of Oxford at the time was Richard Harris, a good and wise man, Philip Pullman says, with whom I very much enjoyed debating. So he's having a dialogue with a bishop about religion. And in fact, this essay is called God and Dust: Notes for a Study Day with the Bishop of Oxford on Not Believing in the Existence of God, on Good and Evil, on Reading His Dark Materials, The Meaning of Dust, and The Republic of Heaven. Okay, that's a lot. Let me unpack that a little bit. One of Philip Pullman's, if you are unaware of him as a writer, one of his series that is highly celebrated is called His Dark Materials, and it's a trilogy. And I highly, highly recommend it. And he has this beautiful heroine in the person of a young girl named Lyra. And I think there has been some film made of this too, or maybe on Netflix, or I don't know. Some of this has been put to the screen as well. So if you have seen this or if you have read this, you know how rich and lush this material is. But it's also challenging if you're coming from a traditional sort of religious, organized religion view of God as a white-bearded man in the sky. If you're following my podcast, that's probably not where you're centering most of your thinking. And so, you know, I just offer that he is offering a very different perspective on religion and its validity. And so here he is, very respectfully having a debate with this Bishop of Oxford in this lecture that I'm going to read portions of to you. And, you know, he's not a big fan of the traditional idea of the religious God, okay? But I think you'll see by the end of his essay that he is talking about what you and I have been talking about in our podcast, with all the different ways we have navigated the subject about who we really are, about these rarefied psychological states, about this magnanimity and power that belongs to us if we do the inner work and do the discipline of not being seduced by the external circumstances of our lives. I think you'll see that Philip Pullman's perspectives are very much akin to C.G. Jung's and what we've been discovering together here in the topics of this podcast. So even though he's not this big fan of religion, and he, you know, very heartfully challenges the bishop, but with great respect, but then he ends up, I think, having a lot to say. So when he refers to his Dark Materials, he's referring to his trilogy, and then The Meaning of Dust and The Republic of Heaven, those are aspects of the story he tells in the series that is that trilogy. So I'll read a few words from the beginning. This is actually from the morning session, just to kind of give you a perspective about where he's coming from in terms of organized religion. And this is going to, I'm offering, really help us support this idea of sovereignty. You know, so hang in there with me a bit. I think you'll see where this is going in a moment, but these are Philip Pullman's words. The first thing to say about the bishop's arguments in his book, God Outside the Box, is that I agree with every word of them, except the words I don't understand, and that the words I don't understand are those such as spirit, spiritual, and God. It may seem disingenuous to say I don't understand them. Surely I know what they mean. Take the words involving spirit. Of course, I know what my dictionary says. Spirit, the animating or life-giving principle in a person or animal, the intelligent, non-physical part of a person, a prevailing mental or moral condition or attitude, a mood, a tendency, the real meaning as opposed to lip service or verbal expression, an immaterial principle formerly thought to govern vital phenomena. Spiritual, of or concerning the spirit as opposed to matter, concerned with sacred or religious things, holy, divine, refined, sensitive, concerned with the soul or spirit, not with external reality. Soul, the spiritual or immaterial part of a human being, often regarded as immortal, the moral or emotional or intellectual nature of a person, and so on. I know how others use these words, and I know how I would use them myself, and I have no difficulty understanding sentences containing them. I can manipulate them like coins or counters in a game and not break any rules and achieve a meaningful result within the context of the game. Nevertheless, it's not a game I choose to enter. I would never begin to talk of a person's spiritual life or refer to someone's profound spirituality or anything of that sort because it doesn't make sense to me. I don't talk about that sort of thing at all because when other people talk about spirituality, I can see nothing in it, in reality, except a sense of vague uplift combined at one end with genuine goodness and modesty and at the other with self-righteousness and pride. That's what they're displaying. That's what seems to be on offer when they interact with the world. And to my mind, it's easier, clearer, and more trustful just to talk about the goodness and the modesty, or about the self-righteousness and pride, without going into the other stuff at all. So the good qualities that the word spiritual implies can be perfectly well covered, and more honestly covered, it seems to me, by other positive words, and we don't need spiritual at all. So I just wanted to throw that in there because I use those words a lot and I totally get what he's saying, you know, and I think it's good to have that other perspective. Like, you know, if you read C.G. Jung, you know, you might navigate these words. Maybe you don't. You know, maybe they're just as foreign and I've been throwing them around and they're kind of mushy, you know, and that's fine. And I just think it's a great perspective to sort of bring that in here and talk about it. And then he goes on to say, you know, how he has a problem with this idea of God. And let me just dive in here. Another word I have difficulty in using sensibly, to put it no more bluntly than that, is the word God. I don't believe there is such a being, and I don't think you can say anything true or useful about a being who doesn't exist, and I don't think it makes any sense to say, for example, God loves each of us as though we were the only person in the world. This strikes me as being an assertion entirely unsupported by anything verifiable. Furthermore, I think that the argument put forward in the chapter of The Silence of God in God Outside the Box, that, in the quoted words of R.S. Thomas, quote, "it is this great absence which is like a presence," is an attempt to have your cake and eat it. It's cheek on a colossal scale. Simone Weil said, "absence is the form in which God is present." Presumably, we're talking about serious things here, as serious as the talk in a court of law, for example. And yet, if you were being cross-examined and you said, "it's the very fact that I did it that proves I didn't," I think you'd be lucky to escape a charge of contempt of court. The argument seems to run, quote, "God is nowhere to be seen, nowhere to be heard. There is nothing to show he exists at all. And yet, to believe in him is evidence not of mental derangement, but of profound spirituality." So anyway, I mean, I just find Philip Pullman delightful. If that's triggering to you, just be with that. You know, let it trigger you. Hold it loosely, because I think you'll see where he's heading shortly, that it's more these packaged ideas of God that, you know, can seem so absurd. So here we go. On to the fuller aspect of what Philip Pullman has to share with us. He goes on to talk about the concept of evil as an adjective or a noun. And he gives his ideas on that. I mean, it's a super rich essay, so I highly recommend you read it for yourself, because there's so much to unpack. But I'm jumping ahead now to the afternoon session of this debate he respectfully had with the bishop. And I'm going to read quite a chunk here from the afternoon session. And here's where it gets really good. "I'm here because I wrote a book, His Dark Materials, and because it's thought that I can argue about the position put forward in that book and defend it or persuade you of its merits. But the transaction isn't as simple as that. When someone reads a book, there are not just two people involved, the writer and the reader. There are several others hanging about. Firstly, there's the actual reader, the person who buys the book or borrows it from the library, who carries it home, who sits down, whose eyes actually move over the page. Secondly, there is the figure known to literary theory as the implied reader, the person the text seems to be addressing. It can't address the real reader because, of course, no one knows who that will be. But to take an obvious example, the implied reader of the Bino is a young child, whereas the implied reader of the work of abstruse philosophy is probably someone academically and professionally interested in that subject. An academic philosopher could be the actual reader of a copy of the Bino, but the Bino doesn't seem to expect that, somehow. Thirdly, there is the author, the actual author, the person who thought up the sentences and wrote them down. Fourthly, there is a figure called the implied author. He or she is the hardest of all these shadows to grasp. The difference between the real reader and the implied reader is easy to understand, but the implied author, though his or her function is real, isn't quite so easy to get at. It might be more easily called the inferred author, because it's the figure felt by the reader to lie behind the book. The combination of all the attitudes, experience, literary skill, and so forth that seems to have gone into its production. Fifthly, there is the narrator. This is the voice that is doing the storytelling. I used to teach English literature to students who were going to be teachers. And one of the things these young people used to find hard to grasp at first was that the third-person storytelling voice in, say, a novel like Vanity Fair wasn't actually Thackeray's own voice, but the narrator's, and that the narrator was just as much an invented character as Becky Sharp or Rawdon Crawley. So the narrator of His Dark Materials is the voice you seem to hear or see on the page, and behind that is the implied author, the imaginary me, whose presence is inferred by the reader, and who seems to be manipulating the narrator, and to be responsible for the attitudes and conclusions of the whole work. And behind that is the real me, who finished writing that book a long time ago and is now busy doing something else entirely. So I'm not going to linger a lot there, but it's really important to bring to the fore how many layers of filter we might be experiencing or reacting to or feeling triggered by. And so that's important just to keep in our awareness just as a matter of practice. So here's where it gets super good in my estimation. One thing that plays an important part in the story is the mysterious entity I call Dust, D-U-S-T. It seems to be connected with human growth and understanding. It might even have a connection with original sin, which is why the theologians in the book are so agitated about it. It seems to be everywhere, to permeate the universe, but at the same time, it gathers more thickly around adults than around children. Dust lies behind many of the motivations of the different characters. At the end of the first part, Lyra, who has witnessed terrible things done by adults against children, reasons that if the people who do terrible things think Dust is bad, then Dust must be good. And in the course of the last book, the scientist Mary Malone, who's been investigating Dust with the help of the amber spyglass of the title, discovers that Dust is leaving the universe in a terrible flood, as if great catastrophe has happened. The loss of Dust would be a disaster beyond imagining, because Dust seems to be a visible analogy or picture or metaphor, not a literal description, I have to say again, of human consciousness. Dust is everywhere, in our hearts and in between the stars. It nurtures us, and it delights in the facts of human love and understanding. In some ways, it's not unlike God. But there's an important difference. Dust, unlike the traditional idea of God, depends on us. We depend on dust in order to live to our full potential, but it depends on us too. If we don't strive to promote knowledge and understanding, if we turn away from compassion and towards fanatical hatred, then dust will wither and die. So it sets up a new kind of relationship between us and God, mutually dependent instead of being hierarchical. He didn't create us. We create each other. Instead of just being subordinate to a king, as we were under the old dispensation, we have an important part to play in keeping God alive. Okay, I'm inserting here. That is what Jung was talking about at the end of his life, too, and particularly in his answer to Job. Okay, back to Philip Pullman. And that's part of what I mean by the Republic of Heaven. We are responsible. We are citizens. This is a democracy. And if we give up on our responsibilities, then tyranny can easily rise again. I'm going to read a passage from the story, which I think has a bearing on this discussion. Mary Malone is observing the dust when she feels a sense of being pulled away from her body. She flung a mental lifeline to that physical self and tried to recall the feeling of being in it, all the sensations that made up being alive, the exact touch of her friend Atal's soft-tipped trunk caressing her neck, the taste of bacon and eggs, the triumphant strain in her muscles as she pulled herself up a rock face, the delicate dancing of her fingers on a computer keyboard, the smell of roasting coffee, the warmth of her bed on a winter night. And gradually she stopped moving. The lifeline held fast, and she felt the weight and strength of the current pushing against her as she hung there in the sky. And then a strange thing happened little by little as she reinforced those sense memories, adding others, tasting an iced margarita in California, sitting under the lemon trees outside a restaurant in Lisbon, scraping the frost off the windscreen of her car. She felt the dust wind easing. The pressure was lessening. But only on her, all around, above and below, the great flood was streaming as fast as ever. Somehow, there was a little patch of stillness around her where the particles were resisting the flow. They were conscious. They felt her anxiety and responded to it, and they began to carry her back to her deserted body, and when she was close enough to see it once more, so heavy, so warm, so safe, a silent sob convulsed her heart, and then she sank back into her body and awoke. She took in a deep, shuddering breath. She pressed her hands and her legs against the rough planks of the platform, and having a minute ago nearly gone mad with fear, she was now suffused with a deep, slow ecstasy at being one with her body and the earth and everything that was matter. So I'm going to pause. This is from The Amber Spyglass, which is a book in the trilogy. The three books in order are The Golden Compass, The Subtle Knife, and then it ends with The Amber Spyglass. Those make up the His Dark Materials trilogy. So having said that, I just want to pause here because Philip Pullman is about to recount a story where he himself experienced something similar. But if you listen to my podcast where I talked about a psychedelic experience I had, I also had a very similar experience. And upon returning to my body, I felt this absolute affection and love for it. So to me, a really essential thread about this sovereign state is that it is to be enjoyed in this earth dimension. It's like shifting the center of gravity when we're able to access this beautiful, powerful, peaceful, transcendent part of ourselves, that psychological wholeness, and have access to that, which she describes here as being so powerful, and he describes as being so powerful and so vibrationally attuned to us, and we're part of it and we're part of it and it's responding to us and we're responding to it. It's this beautiful symphony. And yet, this is not then just to check out and just wait till the second coming of Christ, quote unquote, if you will. This is to come back into the senses, into the embodied state, and love being there with this other perspective as our guide, experiencing itself through the wonder of this physicality that we're in. And I too just had to say, not making this about me, but I had that experience as well, as profound as the experience I shared with you all several times back was for me. The tenderness of returning to this form was so overpowering and so lovely. Now we're back into Philip Pullman talking about his own experience. The sense that the whole universe is alive, not just inanimate, but alive and conscious of meaning, is one that I have felt on two or three occasions, and they made such a deep impression on me that I shall never forget them. One happened during a stormy late afternoon on the coast of North Wales, where I grew up as a teenager. Another happened on a winter evening in London when I was in my middle 20s, just coming in our flat in Barnes from the library in Charing Cross Road where I worked. I've never taken any drug stronger than alcohol or cannabis, and not much of that, so I can't compare it to a drug-induced trance, and there was nothing trance-like about it. I was intensely and ecstatically awake. if anything. I just saw connections between things, similarities, parallels. It was like rhyme, but instead of sounds rhyming, it was meanings that rhymed, and there were endless series of them, and they went on forever in every direction. The whole universe was connected by lines and chains and fields of meaning, and I was part of it. It lasted about a half an hour in each case and then faded. I've hardly ever talked about it because it seems like something whose significance is private. But I found some of the intensity of it coming through in Mary's experience as I described it in this passage I've just read. I mention it now because it seems to me that this is the sort of experience that someone might call spiritual or even mystical. But my whole being shies away from those words like a nervous horse at a firework. Such words seem to imply some sort of contrast between the material and the spiritual. They seem to suggest an experience in which the material world is being transcended or penetrated or lifted aside like a curtain to show us something different or much better beyond it. But that wasn't what I felt at all. It was the physical world itself, which was full of meaning, the precise gray of the clouds streaming over the sea and the white of the spray, the exact angle, the wake of that barge made with the railing of Hammersmith Bridge as I walked across the Thames. There was no sense of the supernatural. I didn't feel at one with God. I felt at one with the physical world, and I saw what it meant, and what it meant was that I belonged in it. So, very briefly summing up, atheist or agnostic, the difference is one of perspective. Seen from one perspective, the total amount of things I know is the tiniest conceivable speck of light, so small it's hardly there at all, against a vast and encircling and illimitable darkness, which is all the things I don't know. There well may be a God out there in the dark, but I don't know, because I can't see that far. But now let's come in closer and closer, bit by bit, to that little speck of light and see what happens as we come closer. Like a camera zooming in, it slowly gets bigger and bigger and grows to fill the screen and grows out wider still until we're there in the middle of the speck of light, and it's not a speck at all anymore. From horizon to horizon, it's filled with light and things to see by it. I mean not only the things I know, but also the conclusions I've drawn from the things I know and the guesses I make based on them. And in all that wide horizon, I can see no evidence for God, not a bit. Everything I can see is perfectly well explained by purely natural things, by the way matter reacts to other matter. I see no intellectual need for the existence of God. I see no moral need for him, and I feel no emotional need. There is not a God-shaped hole in my life. But when I look at the history and the present behavior of the human race, I see a story of infamy, folly, cruelty, and wickedness carried out in the name of a God who is not there. Steven Weinberg said, "Good people have done good things, and evil people have done evil things without the help of religion. But for good people to do evil, that takes religion." And when the bishop talks about human relations and human life, I applaud his good sense, I relish his wisdom, and I admire his good works. But when he speaks of God, he seems to me to be speaking a foreign language, or to be like the person who insists that the fairies are there in the garden, and the very fact that you can't see them proves it beyond all doubt. But if we are to continue talking at all, and I think we must, because conversation is an important part of the Republic of Heaven, if, as I say, we are to continue talking at all, then those are the points at which we have to change the conversation and speak of other things. So I am absolutely gobsmacked by his own somewhat reluctant revelation of that quote-unquote mystical experience where he felt that oneness and aliveness with all of matter. He writes about it in the story. I have experienced that. I have had those moments of grace. I know you have too. It may have been at a time of deep despair, of deep joy. And we will continue to have them. They are moments of grace where things make sense. But I'm offering here that this is also our natural state. And again, it's not a transcendent thing, although it is. But the paradox of that is while it might feel transcendent, it just absolutely floods the physical plane with incredible meaning and incredible beauty. And that's the point. And so I don't find it unnerving at all that Philip Pullman doesn't believe in the religious God, because I experience what he says as the quote-unquote consciousness of the universe that I liken to the God force or the goddess realm. So fill in whatever terms are appropriate for you. But I feel like he's having, you know, and here's a judgment, but I feel like he's having a more sophisticated and evolved conversation about basically the invention of God as it continues to reveal itself. And so Jung would definitely be in alignment with that concept. This, to me, friends, is the sovereign state, but it's not a way of escaping the earthly life. It's a way of shifting that center of gravity so that we are living from it. And when we are in that state, so here's where we're returning to that idea of everything is perfect right now. In those moments of grace, everything is. Like he describes here, just the color of the clouds, it was just absolute perfection. Was there a war going on in the world right then? Probably. Was there sickness and famine and disease and all of these things happening? Yes. I guess on one level, in the external sense, let's say it that way. But in the reality that he was in, just seeing the beauty of that, the only reality that mattered was what was so lit with that sort of inner light and meaning and infusing the physical space. And my point is that sovereign space is also an agent of change. It is a way of, in that moment, saying all is well now, all is perfect now, as much as we can to remember that even when it is not, you know, like doing all the bells and whistles as it does in a moment of grace, to hold that idea that at that level of beingness, of stillness, all is well, that gives us an incredible vehicle for what we will attract and do in the external world to help create situations that are humane and good and serving of life. So I'd like to share a poem now with you that echoes these same themes. And I'll just give you a little bit of background. It's from a book called Risking Everything, 110 Poems of Love and Revelation. And it's edited by Roger Housden. And Roger Housden is a wonderful poetry editor and writer because he picks collections of works. Like some of his books are on love or freedom, and then this one is about risking everything. And he takes poetry and makes it really accessible to people that may be put off by poetry or don't have an understanding of it. And this is found in this Risking Everything volume of his. And so I love him as an editor. But the actual poem is by Derek Walcott. And when I was in grad school, I had to do a presentation, and I had like done this little bit on a film, and I was talking about being seen, quote unquote, being seen. How often do we hear that in the culture in terms of relationship, about people saying, well, I just want to be seen, whether that's from a parent or a lover, you know, in a career sense. We talk about that all the time in the culture. I want to be seen as though that is the best thing. And what I'm offering here, and what I was offering when I did this presentation, is that we must see ourselves. And by that I mean we must become introduced to this sovereignty within us to be seen at all. And then when we are in that state of being seen internally, by universal law, we have to be seen externally. We will have that external experience. It is a way of affecting change as well as dwelling in deep joy and peace. But so often, almost every article in psychology is wired, or in pop psychology, I should say, you know, to being seen. And, you know, if your partner isn't seeing you, you know, dump them and do X, Y, Z or whatever. There's some good material there for good communication skills, etc., love languages, etc. I'm not saying that doesn't have its place, but ultimately, being seen is an inside job. And this poem that I chose to read at the end of my presentation in grad school, I was reading it aloud to the class, and these are beloved, you know, friends of mine, fellow scholars. And I liked this poem. I had chosen it. But as I was reading it, I became overwhelmed with emotion and I started sobbing. And person after person in the room had that same reaction and cried. And I had people like flooding up to embrace me and hold me. And it was just so unexpected. And I knew it was a moment of grace. It was the words, but it was that sovereign thread reaching out into the beautiful physical world with human beings, with hearts and emotions and imperfect lives. And it was touching us all. And that was not planned on my part. So I just had this moment with this actual poem where it was so much larger than anything I could have known was going to happen. And that's what I call God. That's what I call Goddess. That's what I call that consciousness, that life force. So I read it to you here. Love After Love by Derek Walcott. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. Love After Love. So, you know, we learn what we can in relationships with other humans, and that is a big master's lesson, isn't it? We have PhDs in suffering on that, most of us. But we keep going, and we keep expanding, and we keep opening our hearts as best we can to these moments that Philip Pullman is talking about, that I have had the incredible experience of at certain moments in my life. And knowing that intimacy, knowing that sovereign self, and inviting that conversation and relationship with it, and allowing that then to inform all that we do in the physical world, but privileging that relationship first. That is the juice. That is the key to abundance and beautiful relationships of all kinds. And so this sovereign state is something so worth having in our awareness. And with that, I'd like to end by sharing one other passage that I just came across today. And this is by a group called Sacred Dreams, and they added this, and it's called Soul Energy Exchange. And I cannot attribute an author to this, and I will look more because it's not listed here, but that is the attribution I can give at this time. You know, it was this post that I ran across online today. So I will continue to, you know, discover who actually wrote this. It's called Chemistry or Alchemy. The master was asked what was the difference between chemistry and alchemy in couple relationships, and he replied with these beautiful and wise words. People who seek chemistry are love scientists, i.e. they are used to action and reaction. People who encounter alchemy are artists of love, constantly creating new ways of loving. Chemicals love out of necessity, the alchemists by choice. Chemistry dies with time. Alchemy is born through time. Chemistry loves the packaging. Alchemy enjoys the content. Chemistry happens. Alchemy builds itself. Everyone is looking for chemistry. Only a few find alchemy. Chemistry attracts and distracts sexist and feminist. Alchemy integrates the male and female principle. So it transforms into a relationship of free individuals with their own wings rather than an attraction that is subject to the whims of the ego. In conclusion, the master said, looking at his students, alchemy brings together what chemistry separates. Alchemy is royal marriage. Chemistry and divorce we see every day in most couples. Let's start building conscious relationships because chemistry will always make your body age, while alchemy will always caress us from within. I would offer that any true relationship, whether it's with a lover, or a friend, or a soul companion of some kind, or a parent or a child, is only possible on this alchemical level when we have begun a conversation with the sovereign self. And that doesn't mean that other kinds of relationships aren't instructive, aren't helpful as we learn and grow. But this kind of harmonious indwelling, if you will, this flowering from within and shared with another is a precious thing that is the fruit of this labor that we do. So with all of these things together, I hope this has been a rewarding discussion on what sovereignty can be like for us, something to entertain and keep in our awareness. And in the days ahead, you know, it's Tuesday-ish now, Tuesday, Wednesday, by the time I get this posted. By the end of the week, Friday, Saturday, somewhere in there, I invite you to go to my website at lorigreen.net because all that fall and the autumn bring with the return of Persephone going into the underworld in the mythological and psychological sense, I'm doing a lot of updates regarding that on the website. I have some beautiful products that have imagery of sort of that underworld theme that I'll be posting this week. And again, my next podcast will likely talk about Persephone in the reign of the underworld. And I'm also going to be phasing in, I've had this in the past, but I've had a link to my own personal bookshop on my website where I will include a lot of the texts that I have shared with you today. I am going to update that and have that more active. And what it actually links to is bookshop.org. So any titles that you buy through my website are actually benefiting indie bookshops. And that's why I link it that way. But this Philip Pullman text and probably the Roger Housden material, I'll also put on there among a lot of other texts that I've shared with you, the Peter Kingsley stuff, etc. You know, I share so much of other people's work in the context of the podcast that I just want to start linking better with that. So as the week moves on into fall, check out my website at lauriegreen.net and see what's happening there, because there will be more resources and more ways to celebrate these archetypal themes. And thanks for tuning in. Thanks for traveling with me. And until next time, take good care. Hi, everyone. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember to hit subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if my work is nourishing your heart and imagination, consider supporting the Apothecary Podcast. Just follow the links to make a contribution. And for the full scope of my projects and offerings, including my weekly newsletter, visit lauriegreen.net.